and she happened to be with him on the re-election.
I was waiting for you, so she has been patient.
The House Interim Committee on Revenue will come to order. Thank you all so much for being here, and you'll note it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and we're opening an information meeting with a number of items on it today. And we will start with the Office of Economic Analysis, our state economists, who were here only last week. Welcome back. Thank you. And to talk about Oregon's housing market, recent trends and outlooks. Gentlemen.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, thanks for having us again. My name is Mark McMullen, the state economist with the Oregon Office of Economic Analysis, joined, as always, by my colleague, Josh Lehner. So, yeah, we're going to talk about housing at a very high level, supply and demand stuff that we look at.
It is a very high level these days.
That's right. That's right. So, yeah, but we don't. What we look at, we can see these broad trends, but we don't really get a lot of idea about whether or not a building, a luxury apartment in downtown, it works or not, or where we need to extend the UGB or things like that, or what sort of tax credits work. It's all at a pretty high level, but even so, I think we do get some lessons that you can probably apply to when you get into the policy debate here in the coming months. So, yes, as Chair Barnhart mentioned, boy, we're at a high level in housing yet again. It hasn't even been a decade since we had our housing boom, and yet here we are again with prices rising, with demand outstripping the supply, and prices going up very, very rapidly once again. Now, while it looks like we have an overheated market similar to what went on then, the fundamentals behind it are completely different. And so this isn't exactly the same sort of thing. That's one thing we get asked a lot as we go around is, well, geez, is this another bubble? Are we going to have another housing crash? Because, in a lot of places, the rates of appreciation and the like are very similar to what we went through in 2005 through 2007 period. We look at the fundamentals to determine that it's really not the same sort of case. Back then, the issue was demand was artificially high. We were bringing a lot of people into the market and making a lot of sales that probably wouldn't have taken place if not for the dysfunctional mortgage market. You know, we had folks that couldn't afford homes, or were over their price level, or folks that or houses that may not have been in a good market niche, or a good location, or a good or necessarily a high quality. But all of these were selling largely because buyers had the belief that, well, when I can go ahead and sell this next year for 5 or 10% more than I bought it for. So no matter how bad the quality of the thing was, or how little I could afford it, that artificially pumped up demand and created this obviously these great price increases. And at the end of the day, we had a lot of folks left holding the bag, both lenders and buyers, who ended up, when the party stopped, ended up holding the bag, and to a lesser extent, we had some oversupply and some oversupply of houses. And now, this time, it's fundamentally different. This time, it's not artificially supported demand. It's not pumped up, but rather, it's artificially constrained supply. Our supply isn't rising. We're not getting the same response that our market fundamentals would tell us, right? There's a lot of money to be made out there with these prices going up, and there are a lot of profits to be had. But to date, we haven't seen the response that you would expect out of builders, in terms of putting more supply on the market. And so now we have the same sort of thing, a tight market and prices going up, but it's not because of the artificially inflated demand at all. It's because there aren't enough places to live. There aren't enough seats for the butts that we have out there. And so at this point, the implications would be different. It's not that we're risking a crash where the bubble pops and people are left holding the bag, but instead the lack of building is putting a collar on our growth and our ability to expand. And so there are And so we're trying to get to the bottom a little bit in our first section on supply, and to what are the possible things that are broken here in the market? What are the possible things that could be barriers to supply and could be creating the problems? And you know, we hear quite a few of them around when we do talks on housing. One complaint that builders has is it's the government, that it's through tax or regulatory policy, and that restricts people's ability to build. Other folks are complaining about lack of construction workers, that it's very hard to get construction workers, and they're a lot more expensive nowadays than they used to be. Another usual suspect would be lenders and finance. Like there was a breakdown in the opposite direction in terms of financial markets during the boom, a potentially lack of credit for builders and maybe holding things back. And finally, it's also potential that builders are pessimistic about the future. No matter how strong the demand growth is today, looking forward, maybe lenders are afraid that, there's changing tastes in terms of home ownership or debt burdens that young households have, so they won't be able to buy houses, or what's going on in the federal government in terms of interest rate policy or mortgage support, the lack of Fannie and Freddie and the like. Maybe builders are saying, well, we see a lot of demand for housing now, but it's not going to persist outward. So this uncertainty may be holding them back. So with that, I'll let Josh start talking about the recent supply trends, and we'll try to dig deeper into some of these potential market failures.
Thanks, Mark. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, Josh Lehner, Office of Economic Analysis. And we've shown you this chart before over the years in the regular revenue presentations we do, and it's truly an astonishing chart. This shows total number of new housing starts in the state of Oregon back in the 1980s following that crash in terms of the economy in the blue line, and in the red line is what we've seen in the last decade plus our forecast for the next few years in the red line. They're not on two different axes. They're measured on the same scale. The lines overlap each other nearly identically. And this is 35 years later. We have more than a million more people in the state of Oregon today than we did in the 1980s. We have hundreds of thousands of more households today, and household formation and population growth, they're all coming back. We'll talk more about that in a minute. But this just puts it in perspective. Following the early 80s recession, which was worse in the state of Oregon than the Great Recession was in terms of percentage loss of income and jobs and what have you, we're still building literally the same number of housing units today as we did 35 years ago. So the lack of supply response is very real. And you can see it in this chart, just comparing this massive time difference, massive population growth in the ensuing decades, but we're literally building the same number of new units.
Mm-hmm. So one thing that comes up is it just who we are? We like a lot of zoning laws, and in particular, the Portland metropolitan area is kind of famous for some of its land use policies. So is this the question, right? Is it because we're not allowing anyone to build here? And the answer to that is probably no. In particular, looking at the building activity over the last cycle relative to where we are now, Portland looks really no different than other growing metropolitan areas that are in the West and in Texas, like Austin, and the places that tend to show up next to Portland on all of our graphs of metropolitan area performance. You know, all these places are seeing a lack of building that's of a similar scale to what we're seeing in our metropolitan area. And similarly, as we look across the state, here you see the building activity or planned building activity. Permits don't always turn into buildings, but it's a pretty good leading indicator of them. You see here that all of our regions are building significantly less than they were during the boom across the state, and some of these have a lot more or fewer policy barriers in terms of what might stop you from building. So it's policy, of course, plays a role, as always, but it doesn't appear to be the fundamental thing going on right now.
Representative Nose?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious, is this lack of building like single-family housing, or like it's all building, like apartments? Because I feel like where I live, it's nothing but construction. inner southeast Portland.
Yes, Representative Nose, Chair Barnhart. These numbers combine both single and multifamily permitting. However, multifamily permitting has been strong, and particularly in the metropolitan area and in our college towns. We've seen a lot of building on the multifamily side. And
when you say multifamily, you're not thinking, sorry.
No, please.
It's not just duplexes. You mean like apartments or condominiums or
residential.
That's right. That's right. And the high rises. And that is, we have seen quite a bit of that
just,
supply.
Just to finish the thought, you're not counting one building, one unit. You're counting one building, however many units there are in it is what you count.
Correct. Okay. That's right. So multifamily adds up to more. And we'll talk a little bit about that split, because in terms of the demographics, we're kind of at a high water point in terms of demand for multifamily housing. But for the most part, the stuff that we're going to talk about, we join them together, because for us, it doesn't matter really if we're building up or out. For at this very high level, we're just looking at the balance of supply and demand. Are there enough units of some kind for people to live in? Not necessarily talking as much about the mix, which we have less to add to.
Oh, yes, Representative.
If you'll go back to the previous slide, interest rates in 1981 were about 12% to 20%. So if you took out a loan on a house, because I bought a house then, and that's the kind of rates that we were paying. So I wonder how much of that bottoming out that you see may have been related to interest rates of 20%. I recognize that there was a recession there, but versus now, where you're looking at 4%, maybe, you know, 3.5 to 4% in the same time frame. I mean, it's just something to consider that perhaps the interest rates had something to do with that downturn at that time.
Representative Wissett, Chair Barnhart, they most certainly did, and they very much affect affordability every bit as much as house prices do. Of course, in the 80s, there were other things going on. It was the only time Oregon actually lost population, so there were broader trends. But today, they're helping a lot, the lower interest rates, even relative to the housing boom in 05 and 07, and that's only 3 percentage points or something like that. If not for that, housing would be more less affordable today than it was back then.
Thank you.
So it's probably not entirely a policy thing, or it's not policymakers' fault for once. So what could it be? Right? We say, well, what about construction workers? This is something that folks are talking to us about, and so we've looked into the data a little bit, and it does appear that there is a cohort missing, that in terms of our construction workers, the demographics relative to the boom have just shifted, with except for we don't have any of the youngest workers the in their 20s who typically get into the industry. And so this, I suspect, has put a little bit of a lid on some of the supply of construction workers out there. And we see it in terms of the number of establishments not having really recovered at all since the crash. And the way, you know, a lot, and these are specialty trade contractors in Oregon, which is the vast majority of our residential construction workers. And the way establishments typically work in these industries is young workers learn the skills and the trade on the job, and then they go out and start their own firm. And so we had this void of a couple, 3 years of really no building activity, and so no one getting into the construction trades, maybe deciding to go into school or other avenues. And as a result, it's only just now we're starting to see a little bit of pickup in the number of establishments, even though, as you see here, the number of workers per establishment has gone up. We've seen some growth in construction workers, certainly over the last couple of years, but maybe not the total number of establishments. And so it is possible, even though it's not really evident at the high-end wage scale that we're paying a huge premium for construction workers now, it does appear that there is a shortage relative to the past. So this certainly could be a contributing factor to the slowdown or to the lack of building.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is there... I think we hear periodically from policymakers and education leaders that We disinvested in STEM, or what we used to call shop, in high schools. Does any of that play into this as well, or is it really just a function of we stopped building in the recession and there just wasn't a place for young workers to plug in, and so we're just catching up?
Yes, Representative Noss and Representative Chair Barnhart. It is an open question. Typically, when we get into the workforce matching issues, what happens is you get a shortage of workers, and then we get the programs that try to catch up and fill that shortfall. And so some of that might be happening here. That said, I think a lot of these folks in these trades do learn on the job and through apprenticeship and the like, and not necessarily in formal settings.
Yes, Representative Langer.
Thank you. Is it possible that this is speaking to the fact that during the big downturn, only large firms survived, or there was consolidation? I mean, is this saying that there are fewer people engaged in the trade, and that, I mean, I think we do need to invest more in STEM, but is it possibly not speaking to that issue at all, but more to the issue of consolidation within the sector? Because it's hard to survive a downturn if you're little?
Yes, Representative Linegar, Representative Barnhart. Yes, we certainly did lose a lot of the little guys over time, or the ones that survive now are consolidating. But that said, we didn't really see this pattern as strictly at all in other industries. This is very much more pronounced here in construction relative to others, and I don't, off the top of my head, know of a technological reason for that, why there would be a lot more consolidation here than potentially in others.
Did you want to add?
No. So if you can't blame the policymakers, and maybe not even the construction workers, we'll blame the bankers, I guess. And so Josh can talk about that.
Blaming the bankers is always a win. No, just a joke, of course not. So this right here is just kind of looking at lending standards for commercial real estate loans. And commercial real estate, generally in this case, we're talking about multifamily, big high-rises, things like that. But it also includes land development here. And so this graph, it kind of just shows you what share of banks are tightening credit standards and lending standards, and what share of banks are loosening lending standards. It doesn't tell you how much they loosen or how much they tighten. It's just, is it up or down sort of thing. And you can see the difference in the data here is before all these types of loans were lumped together, and then a few years ago they started breaking them out. So that's the difference for the colored on the lines. But it shows that, during the crash, all the banks were tightening. They're tightening lending standards for everything, mortgages and commercial real estate loans, credit cards, automobiles, everything was tightening in a financial crisis. And then they started loosening them up again. And one of the first things that came back in terms of loosening credit standards were high-rise multifamily rental construction. And so they did that for a few years, and we built a lot of multifamily, and a lot of it was in Representative Noss's district, less so elsewhere across the state. But now they're reining that back in. You can see the lines above zero, the dark blue line, multifamily. The bankers are reining in credit standards and tightening them up for the multifamily because they produced a lot of multifamily units in the last 5 years. The one that's a little bit more concerning here would be the light blue line, the construction and land development loans. And this is something, if you talk to the Home Builders Association, this really comes through in what they're seeing on the ground for single-family homes is it's not so much necessarily what the UGB ground boundary looks like. You know, there's 20 years of land supply in there. You can argue about whether that's true or not, but it's really the effective supply within that. It's not just bare dirt. Bare dirt doesn't really count because it takes a long time to get entitlements and utilities in the street and the infrastructure to go along with building it. It's what's the effective lot supply within the UGB that they're really concerned about, particularly over a 1 or 2 year time horizon. And so land development is basically getting money to go out and bulldoze and to level out fields and put in streets and that type of stuff. And now that the fact that we didn't really do very much of that nationwide or here in Oregon, and now they're reining in or they're tightening up the credit standards for these types of loans, that's one that's a little bit more concerning in terms of future supply of housing, both, but and these are national numbers, but certainly here in Oregon, And so that's one that we're certainly keeping an eye on. If you look at the flow or the volume of loans that are going through banks, again, at a national level, they are increasing their lending to single-family builders. And at pretty substantial rates, you know, 5 to 10% a year of growth in these types of loans. However, it still remains half of what it was 10 years ago in terms of the volume of these loans that banks are doing. So we're starting to get there a little bit, but I think the financing and the effective lot supply on the supply constraints are big deals.
Okay, so switching on to demand.
Okay, going on to demand, we'll talk a little bit about supply. Now we'll talk about the demand side of the equation. The first one is just population growth, right? People have been moving to Oregon in droves ever since Lewis and Clark, right? And people have been wanting to move here in both good times and in bad, except the early 1980s was the only time in our modern history where we lost people. People packed up and left the state in the early 1980s. That's never happened in any other time because the economy was so severe. But again, today we're seeing accelerating population growth. Net migration flows are returning to where they were 10 years ago and close to 20 years ago. Now the growth rates are smaller because the base population is so much larger that 20,000, 30,000 people as a share is a much smaller percentage. So our population growth rates are slower than they have been. But the net number of people moving here is starting to get back up there. So the demand for everything is increasing, and housing being one of those in particular. What we're also seeing is composition within the population in terms of...
Chair?
Excuse me. Representative, please.
Thank you. Before you skip on that last cut, can you give us a yearly number right now of in-migration and population increase that we're seeing? I think that's helpful for legislators to be able to share with constituents.
Statewide right now, population growth in Oregon is about 1.3%. It's a little higher in Portland, a little lower in some of the.
But
some
a number, of the number of people,
the number of people
added to Oregon annually.
The net number is around 40,000 right now,
per year,
40,000. And if you yeah.
And what's the rough concentration in the metro area?
So the rough concentration in the metro area is about half of that, a little bit more. I think we're in the neighborhood of 20,000, 25,000 net migration to Portland right now, to the whole metro area.
And follow-up.
Yes, please, yeah.
And you use net migration. That includes in-state childbirth and in-migration. So that's population increase.
Yes, Representative. You see here in this chart, we've broken it down into the numbers are on here. You see over time, the lighter bar is the natural increase, births minus deaths,
yeah.
And then the darker bar is the net migration vis-a-vis international and other states.
Okay, so about 40,000 a year added.
Okay. At this point, but it looks like we're expecting to get up to 60 again here over the next year.
So
the demand is back, at least to the kind of level changes that we're kind of typically seeing in Oregon during expansions.
Excuse me just a moment. I want to go back to make certain I actually understand the light blue versus the dark blue. If I understand what you just said, I think the dark blue is the net change that results from people moving around, people moving in and people moving out, and more people moved out in those couple of years in the early 80s then moved in, and otherwise it's been the other way around. And then the light blue are births minus deaths. So our population, except again in that very early period, continued to grow just because of live births. And then you add to that in migration and it becomes much larger. Is that a reasonable way of looking at this chart?
Chair Barnhart, absolutely, that is correct. The one thing you can't really tell in this chart, though, is that light blue portion is getting smaller over time as the demographics are aging.
Sure.
Births are down and deaths are rising, and will continue to do so.
Unfortunate mix.
Are you saying there's a crisis that we need to adjust?
And that natural that natural increase, you know, when it comes to regional geographies and regional economies in the state, is very important. In a lot of our rural areas, it's already negative.
Solve itself.
That's right. It actually is across much of rural Oregon. We've flipped in terms of our births and death rates, where we're actually seeing natural decreases in population. Places where that trend is bucked would be across the Northeast and here in the Mid Willamette Valley, like Marion County, particularly areas where we have large Hispanic populations.
And one of the really big implications for the housing market in terms of the population growth is the type of population growth we're seeing and the changes within the economy and the labor market overall. What this does is look at total number of households. This one's for Eugene or Lane County. It looks very similar elsewhere across the state by income. Levels. What is your household income level? And here you can see just like we talked about with you guys in the labor market, where we have job polarization, a lot of jobs at the high end of the wage spectrum, a lot of jobs at the low end of the spectrum. You're also kind of seeing that in household formations. This isn't just people moving into the state again. This is just the net compositional change we're seeing in Lane County in the last decade or so. We're seeing more households at the low end of the income spectrum and significantly more at the top end of the income spectrum. There's about 9,000 or 10,000 net household gains in Eugene or Lane County from 2007 to 2015. On net, all of those are in the $7,500, $150,000 household levels and above. And you can see the types of housing they can afford. They can afford $500,000 homes or $2,000 a month apartment rentals. This graph is even more skewed if you look at the Portland metropolitan area. We're talking about 70,000 more households in Portland today that can afford those very expensive $800,000 infill homes and $2,000, $3,000 a month apartment rentals, right? So if you look at the composition of the population with the types of households that we're seeing, the growth is at the high end. So the fact that we're building a lot of luxury-type apartments in the metropolitan areas and some of the more expensive single-family homes as well, it's not just because builders get better margins at the high end. That's true. But we're also seeing that's where the population growth is at the same time. So they are responding to the market or what they're the demand is. It's just we're not building anything for the bulk of the people that are still making in the $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year range. That's where the bulk of the population still is, but the net increase has been all skewed at the high end pretty much across the state.
Please go ahead. Oh, I'm sorry.
So if you took this and you went to Eastern Oregon or east of the Cascades excluding Bend, you would see your very highest rents top out about $1,200 a month or $1,500 a month. You don't see rents in the top half of that in most of Eastern Oregon. I mean, so, you know, we have to remember that these are sort of specific to specific towns, if you will, or, you know, geographic areas, but this wouldn't relate at all to about two-thirds of the geographic area of Oregon.
Absolutely, Representative Whitsett. The way this is defined for affordability, these thresholds using the Eugene MSA is 30% of your monthly income devoted to housing. And so that's what the numbers turn into for the Eugene MSA. Obviously, those vary along with the underlying income levels. And we'll talk a little bit about rural affordability in the next section. But, yeah, no, absolutely. Those thresholds change. But the phenomenon is really the same in terms of the mix if you're looking at the distribution of income, right? The distribution is lower in rural areas, but the middle, they have the same issues in terms of demand being on the high end and to a lesser extent on the low end and not so much in the middle. So in addition to the mix across income groups, we're also seeing changes in the trend in terms of the mix of demand from renting versus home ownership. Here, the blue picture is what our Portland population will look like almost a decade from now as the millennials age into their root-setting years of in their 30s. You see the large spike, population spike there in the at the point in time when a lot of folks start to settle down and buy homes. And traditionally, that's what they've done. That's the red line, is the share of renters by age. So when someone's 20 years old, you know, 4 out of 5 people at 20 years old are renters. At that point in 2013, that was the case. But then over that next 10 to 20 years of their life, that share drops dramatically. So by the time you're in your 40s and 50s, we're looking at more like only 1 out of 5 are renters and 4 out of 5 are homeowners. So there's this big shift in those traditionally in those root-setting years into home ownership. And so there's a lot of talk about how well that homeownership is delayed now for folks, or either
because millennials have different tastes and they'd rather rent and live in urban areas, or because they have financial constraints like student loan debt, and there are other stories saying, oh, why they can't leave the basement. And to a certain extent, all those things are true, but they don't do any sea changing in terms of this. It's probably the case that relative to 2013, all of this has shifted out some. So when you're 30 years old, instead of being 50% likely to be a renter or a homeowner, maybe you're now, you know, 55% renter and 45% homeowner. But this, you don't get away from this cliff in terms of the folks that, as they're getting into the root-setting years, more and more are going to start to buy instead of rent. And so on net, yes. Sorry, Representative Nose.
Okay, I could swear a couple of slides earlier. All right, let me try it this way. I'm struggling with the fact that there's people in my district, a lot of millennials renting, don't think they can afford, like, all the housing that's being built is being built too high end. Maybe that's what I'm reacting to. I could swear a couple of slides before. There's nothing in the middle for them to buy in my area of the world. It's all really expensive.
Yeah, Representative Barnhart, Representative Nose, yes. And a lot of this will require mobility, moving to a cheaper suburbs or the like. Now, that said, we'll talk a little bit about filtering later, which is traditionally, you know, builders are always going to build at the high end. That's, you know, new construction is typically more expensive or nicer than the existing housing stock. But over time, everything gets old. And so in, you know, 20 years for single family, 30 years, it takes a long time for multifamily before these things end up at the bottom end of the market. But it does get there, provided we continue to build new stuff. And so that's the way we look at it coming. And there are a couple of bulges coming down the road of that in terms of the vintages of stuff that was built in the building boom of the 1990s. A lot of that's becoming affordable now. And in the future, you know, 10 years from now, some of the stuff that was built in the 2005, 2007 building boom will start to filter down and hopefully help. But there is a gap. So yeah, so in terms of broader renter share, the other story we get is that we have baby boomers moving back into the city and being urbanized and downsizing and the like. And that is the case, but traditionally we see in the data here it hasn't happened in large numbers until folks get into their 80s and 90s and it's not necessarily for the nightlife at that point. So at any rate,
Representative Vance.
Well, I don't know.
So you've told us about the shift in population from rural to urban. This is a reflection of that increased demand in Portland. This is a natural occurrence as people flock out of the country and swarm into the city. That's going to drive up the housing costs. That's the nature of things. Now, are you going to get to that which is unnatural, or because I still haven't seen it yet? Or is that what you're telling us, what we should expect from what you've told us for the last 4 or 5 years, that is an exodus out of the rural areas and into the urban?
Yes, Representative Vance, Representative Barnhart. Yes, that's true, and those trends will continue. Our advisory groups have a wide range about how big of a deal that is. Some think it's an extremely big deal. But to put this in perspective, I should say, and I should have said this to begin with when I was talking about the share of renters versus homeowners. While I'm talking about the shift moving back towards home ownership and away from renting, it doesn't mean there will be fewer renters, particularly in a place like Portland. The number of renters is going to grow. The number of homeowners is going to grow. It's just the mix between the two that I'm talking about. So, yeah, so we still are expecting urbanization.
Well, please, yes.
Okay, well, what I'm getting at here is everyone wants to find a villain here somewhere for these awfully, awful high rents. My son lives in Portland. He lives in a basement. Okay, and we made offers on 7 homes. We were the 29th one to make an offer on one home. And we didn't get the home, by the way. He's still in the basement. And so the point is there's a whole bunch of people that want to live in Portland. Isn't that your point? And then that's going to drive these things up until something happens more housing units, or people get sick of being so crowded and move back out to the country. Yeah, but I'm waiting for that unnatural thing that you're going to point out that we can then fix in the legislature. I'm just wondering if we're going to hear it.
I'm waiting for it, too.
Representative Benson.
The committee is in agreement. Let's,
I hope you're not holding your breath.
I don't think we're going to hear it,
though. Yeah. So, all right, well, we will talk a little. Now, demand and supply intersect, and now we're talking about the price increase. But just before that, just to put in perspective what we're talking about in terms of these renter shares.
And going back,
basement in my district. Just
yeah.
going back to the idea of, you know, hitting this peak renter. Partly, as Mark said, it's partly demographic. It's partly household finances were crushed, and you couldn't afford to, you know, you couldn't get credit if you lost your job and the foreclosures. You had to wait a certain amount of time before you could go back into home ownership if that was the right choice. And part of it's consumer taste. And so. We're actually already seeing this pendulum swing back towards ownership and away from these high-rise multifamily units on the margin here. And we see it in the latest data that came out last week. This is home ownership rate by age in the Portland metropolitan area. It increased for the first time in more, you know, in a decade. And it increased the most at the youngest end of the spectrum. And again, these are the people that are tendedly, you know, 70-80% renters, but they saw the largest percentage swing back to home ownership as their household finances improved and as they were able to get some mortgage credit. And so we're already seeing the pendulum. This is the first year that we've seen the pendulum officially swing back. We've been talking about for the last year or two that we think the pendulum will swing back towards home ownership and away from these high-rise multifamily units, again, on the margin. But this is the first time it's shown up in the actual data. And so this is what it looks like, right? We're seeing the go back, and as people get into their 30s and their 40s and they're having kids, that home in the suburbs with a good school district looks a lot more attractive than it does when you're 22 and you want to stay out all night. And so this is part of the pattern that we expected to see and is starting to show up in the data, and it's expected to continue to do so a little bit over the coming years.
Yes.
Thank you.
Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So not to beat this too far into the whatever, But so the overall number, even though it's in red, it still is positive, right? That's not any sort of silent indicator. Okay, so the rate of increase is 1.5%. But if you look at how many positives there are in those subgroups, does that mean that the minus in that 45 to 54 was pretty darn big to make the overall only 1.5% when the spikes are so big in those subgroups?
Representative Smith Warner, Representative Barnhart. Yes, this doesn't talk about the composition and what share of the population is a 20-year-old household versus a 30-year-old household. This is just talking about within each cohort or within each population group, you know, what share of them are renting and which share of them are owning.
Okay. Thank you.
So it didn't take long for this for the lack of building to really start to bite in terms of price appreciation and making these markets really tight. In Portland, roughly during the housing boom, we overbuilt some 10,000 units. But since then, now we've underbuilt 25,000 units. So we've gone backwards, and the markets are undeniably tight. Our poster child for that would be Bend. Here are Bend home prices, and the red line's just an artificial 3% growth since the mid-90s, kind of matching our property tax reforms where you would hit the assessed values. And certainly, right after the downturn, we were almost down to that 3% a year line in Bend. It was amazing. I remember traveling there at the time and actually seeing they had the new mill district they had built and their actual tumbleweeds rolling through the mill district at that time. You go back 2 years later and you can't get a hotel room in there. It's phenomenal how much that demand was able to suck up that, because there was clearly overbuilding in Bend in 2007 and 2005, but it didn't take very long for the population growth to suck all that up, and now you're seeing the breakneck price increases again. And this is a poster child, but we're seeing this in a lot of places across the state. And affordability is not just an issue for our urban areas. It very much is for our rural areas as well. And I know I showed this chart to the group a couple of rounds ago. Here we just turn white any county that's part of a metropolitan area. And we're just looking at the rest of the country. And affordability, we're looking at this rough measure is we're just looking at house prices to income and how that varies across counties in the U.S. And the first thing that stands out is vacation and retirement places are relative expensive. relatively expensive to the compared with the local income base. For us, it's our coastal areas, of course, but the mountain ski resorts are the same, and you'll see the boundary waters in the upper Midwest and the Northeast, and you know, lesser extent Florida, are all less affordable than their neighboring states and counties in other states. And that makes sense because there's a lot of demand from investors and second homeowners and the like, and compared with the underlying income base of the local population. And so house prices are bid up relative to what, you know, you would think just based on the folks that live there at the time. But even aside from the issue with our resort and retirement places, you'll see across the broad Mountain West and Northwest, rural areas are relatively unaffordable, and there's quite a few different things going on there. Part of it is certainly a quality premium. You can't get rid of the quality premium of nice places to live, you know. And so, you know, some of these are very beautiful places to live, and you know, and it would be nicer to have a ranch there than maybe. I don't want to disparage something, but in somewhere in the middle of the Great Plains, where
you can say Oklahoma and Kansas. That's where I'm from. So,
okay, Oklahoma and Kansas. Josh was telling me in Kansas they actually a scientific study that it is flatter than a pancake scientifically. some of the quality premium, but when you talk to folks out in the rural areas in eastern Oregon and like, they are complaints about regulation there as well, and construction costs, and which makes sense when you're in remote locations, that construction costs are somewhat higher than they are in places that are closer together and less geographically dispersed.
This will probably be our last graph, and we'll skip the last couple ones just due to because we're out of time. But this gets to the point along the comments of Representative Nose was talking about his district seeing a lot of construction, and there's no question that close in Southeast Portland has seen a lot of construction. But what this graph is designed to show is in blue is the actual number of housing permits issued in the full Portland metropolitan area, the 7-county region, including Clark County and Skamania for that matter, versus what our office's population forecast looks like in red moving forward. How many housing units do we need to build each year to match our population forecast? And so everyone wants to talk about this big boom in construction in close-in Portland. And, yeah, we've seen a decent amount of level on a few specific streets, on Southeast Division, on North Williams, on North Mississippi, in the Pearl District. You know, there's a couple parts of town that have seen a lot of multifamily construction. And the concern is, from a supply and demand imbalance perspective, is people look at those streets and they say, oh, we're good. We built a lot of housing. Well, if you look at the population forecast from our office, from Metro's population forecast and the like, we need to build the same level of construction that we've seen every single year just to keep up with the market we have today. Wow. And if we're not happy with the market we have today, and nobody is because it's too tight, prices are appreciating too quickly, we need to build more than the red lines to make up room. And to get to Representative Bence's point about something fundamentally breaking down in that in that scenario, either we will get prices so high and become a San Francisco type situation in the world where we choke off growth if we don't build enough housing to meet this demand, because this demand's not going away. More people want to live in Portland than we have housing units, and so that is driving up the prices there. Same thing with Seattle, San Francisco, Los Angeles, New York. All the big metropolitan coastal regions are seeing these same trends, and so the choices are we can either continue to build to try and maintain some semblance of affordability, and if we don't, then we know where the price trajectory is going to go even worse. If we build more than the red bars, then there is a chance that we will increase vacancy rates, we'll put some downward pressure on pricing, we'll see some stabilization and affordability will get a little bit better. But this is the red bars, again, just showed relative to population forecast, we need to build the same level of activity as we're doing now every single year just to match supply and demand in the current market.
Yes, Representative Bence, please.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I can't get away from that slide that you showed before the previous slide. Can you go back to it just for a second?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I blew it up.
The one in the United States?
Yes.
Okay. Let's see here.
There it is.
Yeah, slide.
taxpayer.
I think Republicans are in charge there.
So is it? Perhaps you can get this fact for me. In the rural areas, the higher cost housing, I believe, is a reflection of the fact that we don't have any new housing being built. And what you have are rural families, usually older, staying in the house, the only one they can build on the property. The kids have left. They're not there because rural incomes are such that you can't afford to keep them there. So they go to Portland, and that leaves the older people in the house. Thus, there's not a new house being built, and thus the cost of overall housing is higher. And that's what we see on this chart.
Interesting.
The reason that we can't build housing is our land use plan restrictions are such that you can't. Now, you can build them in towns, but nobody's going to build a house in a John Day. Why? No buyer in case they want to leave. And so you've told us all this. You've said people are moving out of these communities. You're not going to build a new house in these stressed little communities because you're afraid you can't get rid of it. Now, you might be able to build one out in the country. Land use planning won't allow it. Now, I want you to double check if I'm right, because it's too easy just to sit here and say it's higher priced housing. I say it's too easy. I just need to know the reason why and see if my take on it's correct.
Thank you, Representative Vance. I'll definitely look into that.
Thank you.
A lot of reasons why these numbers move the way they do, aren't there?
It's all complex.
Absolutely, Representative Barnard. And again, my disclaimer at first, you know, this really high level look that we have of the aggregate data, you know, the devil is in the details with any piece of property or any, you know, real estate investment or anything like that, or policy for that matter. So unfortunately, we can't help with those.
All right. Great. Go ahead.
All right. Thank you. We used up our time, so I...
So we're going to skip the rest of it.
We didn't have much left. There were two more, okay. but I think that's it for our part of the agenda.
All right. Thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for the presentation. And I have to tell you, I appreciate the committee's questions, especially that last one, because I'm interested in the answer to that one, too.
Right.
Thank you. Review of housing-related tax expenditures, Legislative Revenue Office. Is that Chris? No.
Mr. Chair, we've got the housing.
Everybody's coming.
Housing sector is broad enough. It covers
everybody.
Three of our major areas. Okay. So Chris is going to talk about the credit side. Christine does the work on the income tax that would involve subtractions and deductions, which, of course, is a big part of housing policy. And then Kyle, of course, is going to talk about the property tax side.
Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. For the record, Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue Office. And so I'm just going to do a quick overview, not to belabor the point, but we have this table here that lists all of the tax expenditures. It's kind of where housing policy and tax policy meet. They're grouped according to the income tax expenditures and the property tax expenditures. And rather than just walking through all of these and trying to avoid the monotony that can bring on, we're mixing it up a little bit. I'm going to talk about two of the tax credits that you'll be hearing more about with the tax credit review process. And then Christine's going to talk about the rest of the income tax expenditure. She's going to be focusing on a couple of the big ones there that are the top of the chart. There are a couple of policies there that cost significantly more than the others. And then Kyle's going to talk about thematically about the property tax. Now, for the most part, these estimates come from the 2015-17 tax expenditure report. And they're largely based on those. They may have been modified a little bit to focus on housing. Some of the property tax items are a little more expansive. But that's generally how we're going to walk through this. So on the next page here, we have two tax credits, the Affordable Housing Lenders Tax Credit and the Agricultural Worker Housing Construction Tax Credit. And again, you'll be getting more information over the coming months and into the session. We expect these will be part of the review process. The Affordable Lenders Credit is a tax credit for lenders who make below market loans. And the amount of the credit is the difference in finance charges between the below market and the market rate. And it's for the duration of the loan. And the tax credit is certified by the Housing and Community Services Department, and they can issue $17 million in tax credits per year. And you can see, according to the chart there, that it costs the general fund, between $3 and $6 million a year. The second one here is a little more focused. It's ag worker related. It's a 50% credit for the project costs for eligible housing. It is also managed by the Housing Community and Services Department, and up to about $3.6 million in tax credits can be issued each year. And this tax credit, while it's 50% of the eligible project cost, it's taken in equal installments over 5 years. And this one historically has cost about $1 million a year, but I was just looking at, in terms of getting at the live nature of some of this data and working with the Department of Revenue, I was just looking at this before the meeting today, and it looks like the Department of Revenue is getting better information as a result of their computer systems, and the actual cost of this might be around $2 to $2.5 million a year. So some of these numbers can change with better information that we're getting. So that's really just a quick glimpse at the two tax credits that are in the group there. There is a third tax credit. It's related to mobile home parks. It's a $5,000 refundable tax credit if a mobile home park closes and somebody is forced to move. That hasn't, in recent years, that hasn't been used very much, but that's also on the list. It's at the bottom of the list. So with that, we'll pass it on to Christine, who's going to be talking.
Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you. Thank you, Chris. Everybody, nice to see you. I just have a quick question about the mortgage. Do we have any way to separate out first home versus second home in that? Because I was just reading the description on the page after this, that it's all in one.
I think we're about to get to it. Let's let her go ahead.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, Christine Broniak with the Legislative Revenue Office, and Chair Barnhart and Rep. Smith-Warner, at current isn't a way to figure out how many of these are first-time home buyers versus not.
I think she's asking a different question.
First home versus second home, not first time.
Typically estimated that 95% of this is due to first homes, just from census data, and then I will estimate that 5% is for second homes and the value on those. The home mortgage interest deduction is actually the most costly in terms of revenue impact. The tax expenditure report estimates the impact for 15-17 at $962.4 million. And so there, this enables, it's probably the biggest policy to affect residential tax or home, taxpayers and homeowners. And so this is for filers who pay interest on a mortgage that's secured by their home or second home. This is an itemized deduction, and so that means that the amount of deduction between this and property tax would have to exceed the standard deduction for the individual or taxpayer to choose to take advantage of this. There is a bit of an income limit on the total Schedule A deductions that would also apply to this. The latest limits are for AGI greater than $259,400 or $311,300 joint. The amount of the deduction will reduce by 2%. For every $2,500, the taxpayer has an income over that amount, so it's phased down to 20% of the full amount of these deductions. So there's no income limit on 20% of the deduction, but the rest of it is subject to some type of income limit. The next page, I have the sort of time series of this HMI deduction and sort of some numbers there about the amounts of people taking that deduction and also the average. You can see it declines with the housing crisis. There are a number of reasons that could be the case, including things like foreclosures. People could be having some decline in their interest payments because they have taken advantage of lower rates and refinanced their mortgages. They may be simply not purchasing homes or having them foreclosed and be bank-owned. So the It looks as though the trend in HMI is starting to level out a bit here in the latest data we have available, 2013. I'll be looking at 2014 to see if the recovery is beginning to become apparent in this time series.
Chair can't see me.
I'm sorry. Representative Notes, I should have guessed.
That's all right. Yes. I have just a quick question because I want to make sure I'm understanding something. So let's look on this slide, 2013, where it says $4.1 billion home mortgage interest deducted, mm-hmm. and then the average deduction, $8,600, number of deductions. So does that mean it wasn't $4 billion that was subtracted from that's the amount of mortgages that are out there, right? The hit to the general fund, so to speak, is the $962 million I saw on the first slide. Is that the right way to read that?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Nose, that's correct. So this is the deduction claimed for home mortgage interest, and then so the actual revenue impact will work out to roughly around 9% of that. So you can deduct a certain amount from your taxes, and then it results in a lower tax bill, but it tends to be around 9-ish for the revenue impact. So this is an overall amount of the deduction.
So the average amount would be about $750, rough numbers, of the amount of taxes that is foregone by taking this deduction. On the average.
That's correct. So, you know, the average taxpayer would say, okay, I have $8,600 of home mortgage interest this year, and then that would bring their tax down on that income. So the tax rate being, marginal tax rate being 9% for the typical taxpayer.
Okay.
That's the actual.
Check in with the person that does the taxes in our house and have some remedial education.
Right. You know, it may be useful for us to provide members of the committee with a sort of the fundamentals of how taxes are calculated in Oregon, and it might. And I see our leader over here is writing that down, just so everybody knows how to translate the numbers from one category to the next.
Spend a lot
and that's
of
what you're asking about, essentially.
Yeah, I think
every
yeah.
year.
I think I just need a 101.
Well, we do go through this in shorthand pretty fast.
You don't have to bore the committee with my remedial education.
No. Please go ahead.
The $900 million impact is also a two-year impact.
Okay.
That was a biennial impact.
Okay.
Right, that explains why it's double what it should be. Okay.
These are annual figures, yes.
Sure.
These are annual figures. The 900 is a biennial figure. Mm-hmm. Thank you. So if the number looks like it's twice as big as it should be, it's because it's for 2 years.
But that just shows the trend overall. And hopefully it's leveled off. And that would mean the economy is recovering. And so here's a breakdown that we received from the Department of Revenue on the deciles of AGI. So if you take by frequency the AGIs in Oregon and split people up into 10 groups, this is what you would come out with, and it shows the home mortgage interest deduction by the various income groups, and it is clustered there within the highest amount is decile 10, or the highest income group, and the averages generally increase as income rises. There is a bit of an anomaly with the 9,000 average for the people with the lowest AGIs. The thinking is that could be due to potentially people showing losses to business income, but still, you know, carrying a bit of wealth and having a home mortgage interest amount that's a little bit higher than someone who's, you know, actually making that as a salary. So that's the distribution there.
Well, there are also older folks whose deductible expenses are larger than their income, and so they don't owe any taxes. And some of that, one piece of that might be their home mortgage interest.
Yes, potentially.
Health costs, health expenses, right?
Sure. And so moving on, the impact of the next tax expenditure is about half of the what the home mortgage interest deduction is, but this is the deduction for property taxes. And the 15-17 revenue impact was estimated in the tax expenditure report at $424.9 million. And so this is any property taxes that the people hold for non-business property. And it's also part of the itemized deductions. People could claim this, the property taxes, as an itemized deduction if their itemized deductions were greater than their standard deduction. So it doesn't really take much to trigger people to be itemizers. Again, the federal limits on Schedule A deductions overall do apply here too. So the adjusted gross income of greater than $259,000, $400 single, and $311,300 joint apply. And so then the amount of Schedule A deduction is phased out down to 20% of the full amount of these deductions. And so that is an income limit that's applied and does carry through to Oregon taxable income. The time series on the property tax is a little bit less dramatic than the time series on the home mortgage interest deduction. Basically, this is largely probably an artifact of Measure 50 and property taxes being associated with an assessed value that's below a real market value. As the real market values drop, they may not drop enough to affect the assessed value. And so the decline in property tax deduction isn't as great in response to the latest recession. And so you can see there the average deduction is just increasing a little bit over time. And 2014 numbers are yet to come in, but it's likely that they would probably continue to increase. The distribution for this property tax deduction, again, is split up into deciles, and you can see the bulk of it does go to the highest income decile. There is also a greater average property tax deduction as incomes go up, and that means that people who make more money have higher value properties or possibly more properties.
Can we presume that the people at the bottom end are mostly taking the standard deduction and therefore these numbers don't get figured in?
Chair Barnhart, it's possible. It's given the standard deduction in Oregon is the fact that it's relatively low, it doesn't take a whole lot in property value to kind of trigger itemization. There is, because it's additive between the property tax deduction as well as the home mortgage interest deduction, and so between those two things, if it's greater than the $2,300, it would trigger itemization. More likely, you know, people with lower incomes may not actually own property and have or B is likely to own property and have these deductions.
Okay, so let me make certain I understand. In the first decile, you have 162,000 filers. Is that all the filers in the first decile, including those who don't own real property?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay, I think that answers my question. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the 10th decile, under property tax deducted, or for that matter, all of them, the amount we're looking at is the actual deduction after the phase out. Is that correct? No, it's not the deduction before the phase out.
Do you notice how
odd? Representative Vance, that's correct. Yeah,
I mean, I don't want to state the answer. I need to know. Is 817 million number prior to the phase out?
That's correct, Representative Vance. And Chair Barnhart. The number comes through the Schedule A exercise is to reduce the amount by any amount that you're phased out due to your income. And then the statistic that comes here to Oregon is already absent, that phased out amount. So it reflects the amount actually claimed.
That was my question. Yeah, okay. That's great. So the actual amount one might write down could be considerably higher. But because it's phased out, it nets out to the number we're seeing here. That's another way of saying it. Is that there's a whole bunch of interest that people are paying that is not being effectively deducted.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Benz, that's correct. This number would be quite a bit higher here in decile 10 if it were not for that phase out.
Right. And a follow-up.
Yes, please.
This parallels the federal deduction. There's a phase out there also.
Correct. And that's where the phase out originated.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
So those are the two most impactful ones. The next highest, these are just sorted out in descending order. The capital gains on home sales is an exclusion. And these numbers do not end up on any sort of tax form, so the estimates are a little bit, they're not as firm for these types of tax expenditures, but the estimate is $336.1 million in 15-17. So people who have capital gains when they sell their home are allowed to have up to $250,000 or $500,000 in capital gains before having to actually file that on their taxes. There's a requirement on this that the homeowner be in their home for two of the previous 5 years before they sell their home. And this exclusion is only able to be taken once every 2 years at the very most.
Well, actually, no, it's not true.
The next most impactful type of tax expenditure here is a gain on like-kind exchanges. And this is for property owners who exchange two pieces of business and investment property of a like kind. Most real estate will qualify to be like kind, and they each avoid paying capital gains tax on that. The benefits from this tax, they're allocated approximately 50-50 between corporate and personal income taxpayers. But it's possible that this type of tax expenditure may affect the housing supply, and so that's the reason that it's on the list. One of the other ones that may affect housing businesses that provide housing is the accelerated depreciation of rental housing. So this is where rental housing depreciation is deducted from taxable income, and the deduction allowed here is a straight line method, so that is from the value of the home to zero over 27 and a half years. And the revenue impact here is the difference between this depreciation and depreciation under a 40-year straight line method. And so this is for any rental housing that's placed in service after 1986. And properties placed in service before this time could have more rapid depreciation.
Representative Blitzer?
Okay, I just didn't understand something. You were suggesting that gain on like-kind exchanges would somehow affect availability of housing. How would that I'm not understanding that. If it's a like-kind exchange, you have a net zero.
Sure. Chair Barnhart, Representative Whitsitt, the way that it would affect housing availability would be very indirectly, but it could affect the costs for businesses that provide housing and real estate. And if those costs are reduced, maybe the business is a bit more attractive and a bit more housing is it's sort of a very indirect connection.
Thank you. I would say so. I'm not seeing it. If you have a net zero for like kind exchange, I don't see how you could even suggest that would be would contribute to availability. Just I don't know if I'm totally off on that. But
at the point of exchange, because you're not making a sale, you don't have to pay the capital gains tax, and that reduces your business expense.
Okay.
And therefore, the cost to the business owner is lower, and therefore is more likely to be willing to enter into this kind of a transaction given the rents that are available in the market.
Okay. It just seems like it's stretching.
Is that a reasonable way of saying it?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes.
Thanks.
But it's very indirect. You're
it
saying.
Is.
Yeah. Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick question. Is the rental housing depreciation transferable with changes in ownership?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Johnson, I would have to look into that. I don't know at this time.
In other words, would it stay attached to the property that was originally developed, or if it changes hands, does it go away? Could a subsequent owner claim that as well?
Sure. I'll look into that.
Thank you.
So the revenue impacts are quickly winding down here. It's this one is only $33 million. And there's a series of other impacts. Things like rental allowances for clergy housing, capital gains from farm property. Some of the farm property might end up being a residential structure. There are scholarship awards used for housing expenses for students, and then all the way down to the $100,000 impact or less. There would be cancellation of debt for non-farmers as an exclusion, and the mobile home park capital gain subtraction. Also, the mobile home tenant payment is a subtraction, and this is from payments a mobile home park owner may pay tenants if the tenant is required to move the dwelling by something that the owner, some action that the owner took. And so with that, I will turn it over to Kyle.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Kyle Easton, Legislative Revenue Office. And yeah, I'll be talking about the property tax expenditures specific or in some way connected to supporting housing. I was able to identify almost 30 of these, so I won't be stepping through them one at a time. Rather, I figured I'd go through and try to hit some of the high points, maybe some themes. And to help with that, I've actually categorized them into a few different categories that you see up on the screen. But what you see in front of you is the summary table, and then on the following pages is the more detailed information. So what I've put together in the detailed information is listing the tax expenditure name, a description of the tax expenditure, and then also I have a couple columns for if there's specific qualification criteria that's required to meet to obtain the tax expenditure or to receive the benefit, and then the beneficiary column. And an important note on the beneficiaries is where the information was available, and of course, on the property tax side, returns aren't filed the same way, so I don't have any deciles to share with you. But on the beneficiary side, there can be the number of properties they're receiving it. And then I've also tried to highlight in certain cases, especially in the category of the low-income housing, there are sometimes requirements that the property owner pass on the property tax benefit to those low-income renters. So where that is part of the statute, I have tried to highlight that there in the beneficiary column. So that gives you some sense of how I've set up the charts. And one thing before I step into the actual tax expenditures that's important to note from a high-level standpoint is just the property tax base. It's probably important always to note the measure, what's referred to as the Measure 5 limits, the rate limits, and then the Measure 50 growth limits. So what Measure 50 did, of course, is put in that assessed value distinction that limits growth at 3% of value for property that's unchanged. And that's an important thing probably to keep in mind is as you see these real market values increase, and referring to a slide that OEA showed you in the previous presentation, you saw the Deschutes values, the values in Deschutes County, or might have been Bend, really rocket up, come back down, and then go right back up. And they had this flat line down below there that was the 3% growth limit. It's a good thing to, it's a way to visualize how an individual property, while the value might be going up or down, the underlying assessed value is staying pretty constant, and that helps to limit the growth of the property taxes as well. So when you hear about things of 15% growth in rental year over year or something to that effect, the property taxes may be contributing to some extent, but they really are more limited, so they're not the chief contributor when you're seeing those large growth rates in rents. But so moving on to the specific tax expenditures, one other thing I should note on the chart, the revenue estimates, I put it as a revenue benefit, and the distinction there is that's the benefit to the property owner. So that would include the loss and the shift. So on the property tax side, when you have an exemption or a partial exemption, there's two parts. There's a loss to the local governments, and then, of course, there's the shift related to the bond levies.
Representative Vance?
Going back to your point about the property tax, your point is that the 3% limitation applies to existing buildings. Someone builds a brand new one is not going to benefit from that, except to the extent as years pass, right? Because they build something that costs $50 million. They're going to pay property tax on what, $50 million?
Yeah. Well, so Chair Barnhart, Representative Bentz, the benefit would be when a new property comes on the roll, they come on at what's the assessed, it's called the change property ratio. So whatever the real market value is to the assessed value for like properties in the class, so say an apartment complex, whatever that ratio is in the county, that's so if it's $50 million and let's say the ratio is at 50% or something, then it would come on at half of that value. And then the growth limit goes from there forward.
But my,
please, yeah.
Yeah, my point I'm trying to get at is I'm trying to see what items work against us in adding more rental units to our property. And what you just said would be some protection in competitive rents, if you will, when comparing the cost of building new units to that of renting old ones. And I think there's going to be a lot of discussion about how we can get more rental units, and understanding that property tax issue for me would be important.
Yeah.
Just so I can understand then the advantage or not of the older units as compared to newer ones under their property tax system. So I do recall now that you mentioned it, that what's the name of it? What we do when you add something new to that.
Right, an exception event.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I'll have to go back and look at that.
So if you were to take an existing property and expand it, then those new ones come on at that new change property ratio.
Right. Thank you.
Yeah, so moving back, so to actually start stepping through the chart a little bit, the first category I have there is, I lumped it as education. Really what this is related to is the student housing for the most part. So there's four different tax expenditures there. The first one is really an exemption for the student housing that would be on the government-related education institutions, the universities, the colleges. That's the least student
university housing. University residence halls at public universities, for example.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the biggest component by far. The next tax expenditure down, the academies, daycare, and student housing, that's a larger tax expenditure. I've tried to narrow down the revenue benefit, but that would be the student housing at, say, the private nonprofit institutions. And then you have the fraternities and the student housing furnishings as well. So that rounds out the education component. The next category is what I've labeled elderly, and that's tax expenditures related to housing that's specific to elderly. Of course, there's some of the in the low-income charitable category that could be available to individuals that are elderly, but the three that are listed there are the ones that are specifically aimed at elderly housing. And then the biggest, probably the biggest category, and maybe the one most specific in some ways to housing or housing supply, would be the low-income charitable. The largest tax expenditure there being the Housing Authority rental units. So that's just exempting the units of the housing authorities around the state. I believe in the charts, I do have some of the specific numbers of how many housing units those are, if you scroll down to the following pages. Mm-hmm. The next one down is the nonprofit low-income rental housing. A key component of this one and a number of these other low-income tax expenditures is in some cases there may be, it's not a mandate to provide these, but rather there's the option to a city or a county to provide this exemption. And in a number of cases, the exemption would initially be from the city or the county's taxes, and then there'd be an option if the other districts more or less opt in to allow the exemption to be from all the other districts. So the actual value of the property tax exemption would be dependent upon the local characteristics, whether the other districts opt in and how much benefit would be received to the nonprofit owner. And then the other one that I'd probably call attention to, or two more that I'd call attention to on the low-income side, is there's the charitable literary and scientific organizations. So this is a larger catch-all statute. There's a work group actually looking into this a little bit, but the revenue benefit there is a subset of the overall revenue loss. So I know that figure, it's closer to $200 million for the overall tax expenditure, but the subset related to housing is closer to the $12 million range. And then...
Representative Leininger?
Do you know if the Portland housing bond tax measure, because it would have some level of public ownership of those units, I think, as it's structured, would that be exempt from property taxation, or is it specified? Do you know? Would those new units be exempt from property taxation, or would they be on the tax rolls?
Representative Leininger, I'm not familiar with that specific one. To be able to give you a direct answer, I could check into it. Certainly,
I'm sure I could read it.
A lot of these, the low-income ones especially, are properties could qualify under one statute and also another, and there's multiple layers to it. But I'd hate to speculate and give you the wrong answer on that one. But on one thing that I did want to note was there is a tax expenditure. The name is multi-unit rental housing. It was enacted in 2001. It's kind of in the middle of the summary table. That one actually came about in 2001 out of a work group, and there is the revenue impact. This comes from the tax expenditure report. Is listed there at close to $5 million, but it really actually goes to maybe a difficulty in placing value on low-income housing to begin with. And this is not something that's just specific to Oregon, but it's nationwide. It's a topic that certainly gets discussed in the literature, where how you actually place that value on the low-income housing, whether or not you take into account the fact that it might be committed to renting to low-income individuals, or if you ignore that and just value it based upon what its value is on the open market. So what happened in 2001 is there was quite a bit of pending litigation out there, and the work group came up with this special assessment where it essentially assesses this these types of properties based upon their the income approach, their rental income approach to the low-income housing residents. So there is a revenue impact that shows up there. Whether or not that actually exists was part of the litigation going on at the time. So just to note that.
Just to make certain I understand, housing, even rental housing, is usually valued at its market value or its assessed value, depending upon what the purpose is. But yeah, I think what you just said is that in this case, it's going to be valued at its income producing capacity with the restriction that it has on it for low-income housing.
That's correct, Mr. Chair, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. So moving on to the next category, we do have the natural, what's been called the natural resources. That's related to the farm home sites and forest home sites are the two largest ones there. A distinction or important thing to note on that, those two are, it's not the actual improvement, it's not the home itself, it's the underlying land below the home site, so the farm home or the forest home. So the land itself gets the special assessment. It's not the house that sits on that. That's reflected there. excuse me. The next grouping down, I labeled veterans and first responders. Oregon does have a homestead exemption for disabled veterans and their surviving spouses. There's also, that's the bulk of the revenue loss for that category at nearly $30 million. There's also the homestead exemption for active duty military, and then the new one that was put in place during the 2016 session, which is a county option to provide a homestead exemption for it would be the surviving spouse, the first responders that are killed in the line of duty. And that one being so new, there's not a revenue impact available for it. Plus, it is a county option. So it'll be dependent upon what the counties choose to do if they want to implement that. And then the last category is just the other. It's a bit of the catch-all. One thing to note or to draw attention to it in the other is the one at the bottom, the vertical housing development zone. A portion of that tax expenditure could be related to low-income housing, but it's not necessarily part of it. So if there are low-income housing units, there is an option to get a partial exemption on the land of those properties. But I put it in the other category because it's not a requirement for it. So it's hard to say that it's specific to developing low-income housing, because that's not a requirement to meet or to receive the tax expenditure.
And we've touched that recently, haven't we?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's an important thing to note is the revenue impact in the table that I have is different than what's in the governor's tax expenditure report. Partially, at the time, there was a sunset. on that vertical housing one that was recently extended by the legislature.
Thank you.
So that, yeah. That
my memory is working. Okay, yes. Good. That's good to know.
But again, this is an attempt to try to capture most of the tax expenditures that are related to housing. Again, there could be ones on the peripheral that, of course, feed into housing in some way, but these are the ones specific to it. And I think that highlights most of the main points that I wanted to make.
Okay. Questions that we haven't already asked for this group? Thank you very, very much. And I'd ask the committee to note the amounts of these various deductions and credits and so forth and pull the different pieces together. And now we're going to move on to a review of state and federal housing subsidies from Housing and Community Services Department. There you go. My. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much. Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart and committee members. I'm very happy to be here this afternoon to share with you a little bit about what's going on at Housing and Community Services. My name is Claire Seguin, and I am the interim director at Housing and Community Services. I've been hot on the job now since about mid-May, so I will just ask for a little bit of forgiveness in this presentation, just in case I don't have all of your answers. I will do my very best, but if not, I will rely on my trusty staff to follow up with you afterwards, to follow up on whatever we need to.
Thank you. And the last time you and I met, I think, was at your old job at NEDCO in Springfield.
That's right. Absolutely. We were talking about foreclosure issues, which still are with us today. I thought I'd start off with a basic history of the agency. And basically, the Housing Division of the Department of Commerce was created in 1971. In 1987, a freestanding housing finance agency, which is what we are today, was established. And we have some primary functions with that entity, and that's to issue federal tax-exempt bonds, low-income housing tax credits, and we award various HUD grants. The community services portion of our agency was added in 1991, and the role has evolved over time, and we now administer certain HUD Section 8 contracts, and that's primarily project-based, not the voucher program, which is administered by the housing authorities. We have some entitlement grants. We have the hardest hits funds from the Treasury, and we just recently got another $94.5 million for foreclosure for that program. And then we have state-funded financing tools. We have a very important mission and vision. As we heard earlier, the impacts of the housing crisis are still being felt strongly in the state of Oregon. And our vision is that all Oregonians have the opportunity to pursue prosperity and live free from poverty. But our mission is to provide stable and affordable housing and engage leaders to develop integrated statewide policy that addresses poverty and provides opportunity for all Oregonians. So I would like to stress the affordable housing side of our work. Obviously, we don't handle all housing issues for the state, but we focus primarily on the affordable housing needs of our Oregonians. We have two primary goals at Oregon Housing and Community Services. One is that we hope to help provide economic security for people by strengthening our entire housing system from homelessness to home ownership and asset building. And then we also hope as an agency to continually work on our processes and approaches to serve more Oregonians because we know the need is so great. Fundamentally, we believe, as do other folks, and studies will back us up on this, that housing is foundational to thriving communities. And so we believe that we play a really important role in improving the lives of Oregonians. But we also know we don't do it alone. We have other partners that we are very intentionally partnering with on a number of projects that touch on health and safety and education and economics. And we are very dedicated to working on those collaborations and strengthening them in almost everything that we do. So our work, it basically consists of two sides of the house. We have the housing finance side of the house, which tends to be responsible for development and building units primarily. And then we have the housing stabilization side of the house, which is where all of our community services programs and asset building programs live. So this next one's a little scary, but it's really just an illustration of how we are funded and what types of partners we work with on the housing finance side. As you all are well aware, we have federal funds, and then we have state funds, which include tax credits and whatnot. We also have other funds that we receive from various sources as well that we can put into our programs. You can see across the bottom that there are lots of examples of really great partnerships. We have great CDC, Community Development Corporation partnerships. We have affordable housing developers. We have housing resource centers. We have all kinds of folks who help us do this work. And it's a very complex financing structure that we have at Housing and Community Services on the Housing Finance Agency side. You can see on the housing stabilization side, things look a little bit simpler, but I would say we still have quite a few different funding sources. And we have a lot of similar partners, some of the same partners, in fact. But we also really rely heavily on our community action agency partners as well. So the housing stabilization funds also has some federal funds, state funds, and other funds included. Our agency really is made up of these six primary areas of focus, and I'd like to talk about each one individually. So our homelessness prevention programs are really to serve folks who are in varying stages of either current homelessness or at risk of homelessness. And at this point, we have multiple funding sources that are working on this. We have our community, or our continuums of care. We have our community action agency networks, and they are all working diligently to try to get to the crux of the various issues. And as you imagine, and as you all know firsthand, there are lots of reasons in each of the communities why we are dealing with homeless issues. But our network and our funding sources are able to get right to the crux of the matter with rent assistance and temporary shelters and things like that. As an agency, we are really focused on simplifying and aligning our eligibility processes, which we think is important. If you are struggling as a person in the state of Oregon, we don't want you to have to fill out multiple applications everywhere you go. We want you to be able to access services without having to not have transportation to get there, those sorts of things. So we build our programs to be responsive. We also, again, partner with some of our key partners in this realm, and that's the Health Authority and the Department of Human Services, to try to see where we can find economies and efficiencies together. So we've got great working relationships there. We also have been improving our data collection. I don't know if you all had a chance to take a look at our poverty report, but it's pretty spectacular in terms of the information that it gives you by your county. So if you're interested, it's on our website, but we are able now to get deeper and deeper into the data facts about what's happening around poverty and homelessness in our counties. And then, of course, as most folks are, we are striving every day to get better at what we measure and how we measure it and how we know for sure we're moving the dial and really making a difference, not just counting folks we see, but counting and figuring out how to measure the change in their lives so that we know everything we invest in and that you all invest in is effective. We also have energy assistance programs. We have quite a few different funding sources for this work, but this helps low-income Oregonians with bill payment assistance. A lot of case management goes along with these programs, and this is handled primarily through our Community Action Agency network. They are experts at this. Their intake processes are thorough. They are able to connect all kinds of resources to folks when they come in, and we're really lucky to have a statewide network like we do. Recently, we've been focusing on some improved alignment with our Native American tribal assistance program. We've been able to get some more dollars to the tribal communities who are interested, and that's been really terrific. We're excited about that. Again, we're streamlining processes wherever we can, internally and with our partner agencies. And we, too, on the energy side, are looking at performance measures, and we are looking at performance-based contracting sort of across the board. weatherization falls under our energy services section. And this program, fortunately for us, has a lot of great support as well in terms of funding sources. Community Action Agency, rock stars in this world. This is a really technical business of trying to weatherize people's homes and to try to make a difference in the bills that they have to pay based on the weatherization process that we do. It's highly technical. It's measured with high-tech equipment and all kinds of things. So in order to do this work, we invest a lot in the training and technical abilities of the folks in our network who are doing this work. The contractors are certified. The caseworkers know a lot. So it's a very extensive program and very effective at preserving some of our affordable housing just by the very means of weatherizing it. So then we come to our big work, which tends to be the multifamily housing work. All the work we do is incredibly essential, but the multifamily housing work that we do is our largest pot of money. It tends to get the highest visibility, and it is all about getting units on the ground. We have some recent targeting populations that we're working with through the LIFT program. We are trying to facilitate more workforce housing and mixed income housing by combining funding sources. And again, we're trying to simplify and align the way we put our dollars out the door. And I'll talk more about that as we go along. But it's a huge body of work. It's about half of the agency in terms of staff and oversight. So currently, we have this series of NOFAs out on the street, one that'll be coming out onto the street next week. That's our Notice of Funding Availability. And you can see how much money has gone out the door. It's our biggest push right now. We were so fortunate in the last legislative session to get such incredible investment in housing work and in the EHA homeless work that we're doing. And so our mission truly has been focused on getting these dollars out to people on the street who need it. We know that we have thousands and thousands of units that need to be built. And if we don't get our NOFAs out the door, they're not going to get under construction quick enough. I mean, at this point, nothing's happening quick enough, right? We need these units built. But this is our timetable. These are the dollar amounts that are happening. It's exciting when we think about mental health housing, let's say in particular, the partnerships that we're working on there. The Local Innovation and Fast Track Housing Program, the $40 million, that's a brand new funding source. And that brings us opportunities to do business a little bit differently than we have to do with some of the other more complicated funding sources. So, of course, we're very excited about that. And then we have the manufactured home park preservation, and probably you all have seen some of the articles recently about all the work around park preservation and trying to help those folks not lose that affordable housing. So we have a Housing Stability Council, which is appointed by the governor to oversee our expenditures, and they have agreed to do double duty in November and December to make the awards so that this money gets out on the street even faster than normal. So we're really appreciative of their commitment and their ability to give us that dedicated time. So the LIFT program is, as I said, it's a new one. It's a new funding source, the Article 11Q bonds. So far, where we are is that we have had the program is out. We've had a training, and we were thrilled with the response to the training. We had 25 folks in the room, and we had 30 folks on the phone. So we are very, very optimistic about what we're going to see coming in through the door with this brand new program. We also handle home ownership programs for the state of Oregon. We have a single family section, and they have several different programs. But what I wanted to highlight here really is that we also, in order to be successful with our home ownership programs, the state has a network of home ownership centers across the state. They cover every county in Oregon, and they provide one-on-one counseling, down payment assistance. They offer up all of the programs that are funded through the state. And they are another amazing network. And so if my message isn't very clear about this, wow, we couldn't do this without our networks. And we are really fortunate here to have different groups of experienced stakeholders who participate in almost every part of our continuum of work. And the last thing I wanted to share with you is just a quick slide about our IDA accounts, our individual development accounts. And this is our match savings program for the state of Oregon. And it's a tax credit program. And it's a 3-to-1 match on folks who save for different asset types. And the third bullet is the list of asset classes. We really believe that as an agency, it is prudent and works very well to have this full continuum of services available all the way through to this asset building world. And so we're very excited to have that network in place as well. It is also statewide. We just happen to be the largest IDA initiative in the country, and we're very proud of that. And our results stand behind the great work. We can tell story after story after story of lives changed by this particular program all on its own.
Question.
Yes, Representative, what's it?
So you were in a previous committee.
Yes, I was.
That I was in. And so on your multifamily or your loans.
Under the notice of fund availability, that list?
Yes. Mm-hmm. How many of the 17,700 homes that are being subsidized, the mortgages that are in arrears, in Oregon right now are those homes? I mean, are you keeping track of that federal money that we talked about previously? The federal government gave us $220 million for people who are behind in their mortgages. Does any of that go to these homes that we're already paying their essentially down payments on for people to buy and this sort of thing?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Whitsitt, we are required to do unduplicated work with the foreclosure program. I will double check on that as a part of our follow-up on the foreclosure work. I'll make sure that I get that answer really definitively and really tied down. But I know that the foreclosure work itself has a pretty strict criteria about how we don't duplicate counts. So I'll just double check the connection against the other programs for you to be sure.
I think what you just said was you're not supposed to use one program and then a different program to increase the subsidy.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Yes. Thank you.
Yes. Yeah. Because we're looking at about 18,000 homes that are on a federal program right now or will be for mortgages that are in arrears up to 24 months, the federal government is paying. And so what I'm trying to determine, are we paying anything? Is any of that federal money going to all homes that are being subsidized under something else?
Right. Okay. I'll just absolutely clearly follow up on that. Thank you.
Great. Yeah. Go ahead.
I'm good.
Oh, we got to the
We're at the end.
We got to the bottom of it. Now, I recognize several of these items from the time when you were running the NEDCO programs, the individual development accounts, the home ownership issues, and some of the others as well. So that must be one of your local affiliates that works on actually dealing with the actual clients who are needing the assistance of your program.
That's true, Chair Barnhart. NEDCO is one of the members in the homeownership network, and they also are one of our foreclosure locations that does a lot of counseling work there. And, of course, this work is clearly my passion.
Yeah.
I'm continuing it now here at the state.
I can see that. Just to back up just for a minute, you were talking about things like weatherization and energy assistance. And I noted as you were describing that the IOUs, the Portland General Electric and Pacific Power, are funding sources. Are these actually statewide programs, or are they limited to the areas where those IOUs actually distribute energy?
For the most part, they are limited to the area where they are collecting meter by meters.
So in Eugene, for example, Eugene Water and Electric Board has its own program that does similar things, but they finance it a different way.
That's right. That's not included in
not
our work.
Not included in this. Okay.
Yes.
Other questions? Yes, Representative Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Follow-up on your question. We've received information in the Energy and Environment Committee about the Energy Assistance Program that it is oversubscribed already, and we could probably serve up to five times the number of people that you can now. So I know the answer to that one on terms of subscription. What about weatherization? Is that also a program that's fully subscribed? You got enough applications for people to have that work done that we're using up all the money available?
I would say, Chair Barnhart and Representative Helm, that it is not oversubscribed in the way the Energy Assistance Bill Pay program is. Our challenge with those dollars is that the projects are much more complicated and take a much longer time frame to go from start to finish. So we always have a certain amount of dollars in that fund that are rolling over. Mm-hmm. And I think at some point, candidly, we may get to a point where things are saturated, mm-hmm. Where we've worked in an area enough that all the houses we can help are weatherized, if you will. And so we may be looking and working with our partners to figure out alternatives for what to do with the weatherization program. But that is not true statewide. So we now have the data so that we can cross-reference and look by every, you know, geography and see really what the need is, make sure the action agencies have the resources they need to get every single dollar out onto the street as often as we can. So we monitor it pretty closely.
Thank you. That's right, yes.
If there are particular program elements that could be streamlined that you think would make it easier, that we could help with, I'd certainly be interested in knowing.
That's terrific. Thank you. We will.
All right. Thank you so much. I think we must have, you must have answered our questions.
Terrific. Thank you so much.
Thank you. So it is now 4:15. Time to hear about emergency communications tax revenue collections. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. Representative Smith Warner is pointing out that, of course, it's not actually 4:15. We're just actually a little bit ahead of time, which is great.
Which is unheard of.
Are the people here who need to present for that item? Yeah, please. Department of Revenue, Legislative Revenue Office.
Okay. So good afternoon again, Mr. Chair. I'm going to start things off with a little bit of background on the Emergency 911 tax and then also hit some of the high points of the legislation in 2014 that made some changes to the tax structure before handing things off to the Department of Revenue that can give you an update and a sneak preview a bit of a report that they'll be presenting in February, this coming February.
Bravo. Thank you.
So I'll be working from, there's a document on OLSIS, the E911 background. but so the structure of the 911 tax here in Oregon, I should note that just to start off, the tax does, it is scheduled to sunset right now, 12/31 in 2021, which is consistent with what has been in the past, where there has been a sunset and then the legislature reviews it. But so the tax, the 901 tax is imposed on consumers and paying retail subscribers. They are the ones that are responsible for the liability of the tax, with the providers and sellers are the ones that actually collect and remit the tax on behalf of the actual consumers with service to the 911 tax, the 911 system. And I have in two boxes set up to display the distinction of the tax between prepaid wireless telecommunications and non-prepaid wireless communications, which includes wireline and also voice over internet protocol. So for the non-prepaid wireless, the tax is set at 75 cents per month per subscriber line. On the prepaid wireless side, it's 75 cents per retail transaction. And contained within the statute is the definition of prepaid wireless telecommunication. This definitional changes, they were added in the legislation as well, House Bill 4055 in 2014, but it's defined as service that is sold in predetermined units or dollar amounts that must be paid for in advance. And retail transaction is each individual purchase associated with an individual access number of prepaid wireless telecom service. So prepaid wireless, there are distinctions or different styles, I guess, of prepaid wireless for sure. There are the ones you can think of what's referred to as the burner phones, where people maybe they buy a phone, it's more or less a disposable phone in some ways, and then they can add minutes through cards or just adding it through the plan. And then there are other prepaid wireless plans that function in a lot of ways like the non-prepaid plans. They just are non-contract plans. So they sound similar, but it's just it's almost like a month-to-month thing. But it's, I think it's maybe a common misconception in what prepaid wireless actually is, where everybody assumes it is just these burner phones, and that's not necessarily the case. It's actually much broader than just those, you know, disposable phones. But so the retail transaction is defined. It's the sale of the actual minutes. So in many cases, the prepaid wireless will be almost, you just do it monthly, and it's just a rolling thing. It's almost an automatic. It just charges your credit card or something to that effect. So it really is one transaction a month. So it's very similar in that case. In other ways, if you're loading it up on your own, if you're loading up more time every 2 weeks or something to that effect, you then would be charged the 75 cents every time you load more minutes to the phone. So that's an important distinction. So there could be an opportunity where it's not necessarily an apples-to-apples comparison with the 75 cents per month. One of the important distinctions in the fourth bullet, the fifth bullet in the prepaid wireless telecommunications box there, is that the sellers of prepaid wireless as part of the 2014 legislation are allowed to retain 2% of the tax collected to cover their admin costs. But that's the general structure of where we are today. Again, House Bill 4055 in 2014 made a number of those changes and include the definition of VoIP or voice over internet protocol, and it also added the structure for the prepaid wireless telecommunications. The tax on the prepaid wireless came into effect 10/1/2015. However, there was a transitional period, a temporary transitional period that covered the January 1st, 2015 to 9/30/2015. So we do have, we can begin to see some of these changes in the receipts that are coming in. Again, these the tax receipts come in quarterly, so there is a little bit of a delay from the 10/1/2015, but we are beginning to see what the new structure looks like in the overall receipts for the 911. I did note the tax distribution. So there are, to help cover the admin costs for both the Department of Revenue that collects the tax and then the Office of Emergency Management, which actually distributes the funds, DOR can keep up to 1% of the receipts, and then Office of Emergency Management can keep up to 4%. But after those admin costs, it's then the distribution is 65% is going to cities or counties on a per capita basis, and then the other 35% is going, it works in some ways as a grant, but it goes into the enhanced 911 sub account, which is in some ways a grant account used to fund expenses of the 911 system, making upgrades and such. But that comes out of the Office of Emergency Management distributes those. On the document that I have up in OLIS, I thought I'd include, prior to getting into the receipts that we've seen in the past few years, is a chart that's showing the national subscriptions by the type of subscription. So we have VoIP, wireline, and then mobile, which includes both the prepaid wireless and the postpaid wireless. And I only have going back to 2009, but even from just 2009 forward to 2015, you can see the movement that's coming from the traditional, or what would have been the traditional wireline from maybe 20 years ago, was at 32%. In 2015 is down to 15%. VoIP has gone from 6% up to 13%. And then mobile has continued to increase from 63% to 72%. So it helps to provide some context of some of the need, if you will, for some of the changes in House Bill 4055 in 2014.
Thank you. Questions here? I have one. The top of the page, of the second page, after deduction for administrative expenses, 35% is transferred in the enhanced 911 sub-account. All right, that fund, if I read the last sentence, is used to make direct payments to the vendors for the public safety answering points, circuit charges, and software upgrades. So that goes directly into the 911 operating system, in effect. Local governments use the revenue to partially fund the expense of public safety answering points across city and county governments. I wanted to make certain I understood that the word partially indicates that they have to add other funds in order to pay for this, not that some of this money goes to this account and some goes somewhere else.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's a very important and accurate distinction.
So which is it?
It's to partially fund it, so it's not necessarily, it doesn't cover all the costs.
Right.
In fact, there are provisions that allow, even on the property tax side, for a special district related to 911.
Okay, so cities and counties have to come up with additional money in addition to this money in order to actually pay for their systems.
Yes, that is true.
Thank you. I just want to make sure I understood what partially meant. It depends on what word partially modifies, and it wasn't clear from the way the sentence was constructed. Representative Benz, please.
Thank you, Chair. The E-911 receipts by fiscal year, have you reached that chart already? It's down below the next one. Are you working your way toward it? Or?
Yeah, that was the next one.
Yes, no, I'll wait then. I mean, are you going to talk about it, or do I need to ask you a question?
Well, the chart is, it's displaying the receipts by fiscal year. And what I was going to highlight was you can begin to see in that 2016 a bit of that uptick. And again, we don't have a full fiscal year worth of the receipts because of the delay in how the quarter receipts come in. But you can begin to understand, or we can begin to see, and as time goes along, we'll have more time to tease out exactly what we think this revenue lift may be. The original revenue impact estimate, I think it put it at about $1.5 million of biennium.
So this is an estimate?
No, these are actuals. Just seeing that the bar in 2016
fiscal
is
year.
Higher.
Okay. Year ending June 30th.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. So we'll,
Right. It is about 16. I just want to know how far into the year that shows us. Is that 1 month, 3 months? How far is it?
That's into the fiscal year, so it'd be through June of 2016.
It's a year for ending June 30th.
So it's complete.
So it is.
No. So tell us again the year. It says fiscal year. You mean this began? Are you taking us all the way through? That would take us all the way through 16 for purposes of 16, and we would start 16 and go into 17. So I just was curious how far that takes us.
Representative Benz, it'd be fiscal year ending, so it'd be through the June 30th, 2016 receipt. So just a few months.
Okay,
ago.
So for calendar year purposes, we don't know yet.
Yeah. Right. The reason I structured it for calendar year was to try to be able to capture the full amount. And there was, I actually just saw the receipts, the monthly financial statement for August came in from the Department of Revenue. And there was an uptick in the previous month, but it actually looks like it was just a shift in a payment from what we would expect in August. Came a month early. So part of that was to hide any irregularities with the data, showing it from a fiscal year standpoint rather than doing a month or something to that effect. Because it at one point, it looked like there was a very high uptick of, say, $7 million in 1 year. Mm. And then now that we have that 1 month that came in this morning, we know, it looks like that was just pulled forward from another month. So I didn't want to have to try to explain away a data issue.
All right. Other questions on this part? Please.
All right. Thank you. For the record, my name is Deanna Mack. I'm with the Oregon Department of Revenue, and I'm here to talk about the 911 program. As Kyle mentioned, Section 13B of the 2014 House Bill 4055 required a report by the department on or before February 15th, 2017. So we're not here to present that report yet, but we are going to tell you a little bit about what it will contain. So we plan to include in the report in the outcomes of the temporary tax. Like Kyle said, it was a 9-month window in 2015 that providers remitted the tax from January 1 through October 1 of 2015 before the collection of the tax began at the point of sale. In anticipation of that new retail tax, we made significant outreach efforts to ensure folks knew about their filing and remitting obligations. Our efforts to inform telecommunication providers and retailers of this began in December of 2014. So we requested a list of third-party sellers of wireless products from telecommunications providers. However, we did not receive a list from any of them. We did identify, based on NAICS codes, about 4,000 potential retailers in our tax accounting system, and we sent letters to them informing them of their obligation to begin collecting this tax. The list was narrowed as businesses contacted us to tell us that they didn't sell prepaid wireless cards or products. We then sent three separate letters to emergency communication taxpayers and tax preparers explaining the law and the filing requirements. We even had our DOR the tobacco tax inspectors leave flyers while they were doing their tax inspections if they saw that they were selling retail cards so that they would know about their obligation. We also issued a press release about it in October of 2015, but we don't think that the media was particularly interested in it because we never saw it picked up in any media reports. And then we sent a final letter again in December of 2015 to remind retailers about the first quarterly return that it was due in January of 2016. So in the report, we do plan to talk about the outcomes of the new tax. We'll have a little bit more data, like Kyle was saying. We just have a little bit of 2016 to report so far. But since it is so new, we only have 3/4 of information at this point. So we're just beginning our enforcement efforts. But what we're seeing so far is that we have not received as many returns as we initially expected. Based on our initial estimates, when 4055 was being passed, we expected to receive up to about 4,000, returns from retail locations in Oregon. However, the filing requirement is based on tax ID number, rather than a physical address. So if they have the same FEIN for maybe 150 locations, we're getting one return for all of those locations. We do have about 135 retailers filing and paying the tax now. And the number of providers that are collecting the tax has remained consistent at about 160, which I think we reported to you a couple years ago when the bill was being passed. So with 3/4 of filing of returns filed so far, we have started filing enforcement. We have sent demand to file notices to about 53 providers that we believe should be filing or remitting the tax or both. There was a little bit of education we had to do for folks right out of the gates because they thought it was an annual tax return instead of a quarterly tax return. So nearly all of those 2015 fourth quarter returns have come in now that we've explained to them that it's a quarterly filing process. We have identified about 100 online retailers of prepaid wireless products and have begun the filing enforcement process on them to bring them into compliance because they're selling into Oregon, so they have nexus with us. And currently we have a handful of audits in progress that we think we can use to do some collateral filing enforcement as well. We'll cross-match the information from those into the filing enforcement to see if those folks have filed returns. So far we've only completed 2 audits, but the results of those audits show that the folks are generally compliant with what you expect, which is good news. And we also believe the majority of your big retail chains are in compliance based on what we're seeing. So far, we've learned a few things about the return processing. Like Kyle mentioned, they are able to retain 2% of the tax for their administrative costs, and some folks didn't realize that. So we've had to process some refunds. Paid the full amount and didn't keep the discount. It's interesting, though. I thought we should alert you to this notion that interest on refunds wasn't really considered in this bill, and so there is no real provision for how interest is calculated. So it actually goes back to the date that the payment was made, which is very unusual. It's not that we can't administer it. We can certainly administer it, but it is unusual compared to our other programs because usually interest doesn't start to begin to calculate or accrue until after a due date of some return or 45 days after a due date of return. So in the scenario that I'm explaining, perhaps the payment came in January, but the return wasn't due until April. We didn't know a refund was required until then. Usually under all our other tax programs, interest begins to accrue sometime after the due date. In this case, refund would go all the way back. The interest would go all the way back to January. So we just want to alert you to that little tidbit. We also are identifying internet sellers that don't maintain physical locations in Oregon. Obviously, they're more difficult to identify. So we're working on, like I said, about 100 companies appear to be doing business as retailers here in Oregon, and only about 20 of them are currently filing and paying tax. So we are working to get them into compliance. We've also found that some providers are taking the discount in error. So they're not allowed to take it for the voice over net internet protocol, VoIP, but they are for the prepaid wireless. So we're trying to educate them in that area as well. So finally, the report will include a summary of revenue expectations based on actual information. There's some interesting language in there about estimating revenue in kind of a past tense. But we'll work with your legislative revenue office and Kyle to estimate future revenues as would be the normal practice. And we plan to have that report finalized before the February due date, early in session, so we can come back to the committee and discuss it then. So if you have any questions, I'm happy to try and answer them for you.
Thank you. Questions? Sounds like things are going pretty well. In your comments about the 100 internet sales companies, mm-hmm. I think you said 20 of them are actually in compliance now. Are those are those voice over internet protocol companies, or are they cell phone companies, or both?
Mr. Chair, I believe that they're people that we think should be filing for prepaid services.
Prepaid services.
Yeah, in Oregon. So as you know, we have issues within the tobacco program with online retailers. Online services is an issue nationally, trying to get people to pay taxes for when they're doing business in certain states.
Right.
So it's just another area of taxation that we're working on, and we're trying to get these people in compliance.
So the national movement around sales tax issues mm-hmm. probably is helpful for you,
mm-hmm.
I'm guessing.
The streamlined sales tax?
Well, I'm thinking about the enforcement of taxes on companies that are outside of the state but who have nexus. Are there companies that don't have nexus that are selling into Oregon and therefore you're not able to collect the tax from them, or do you know?
Mr. Chair, as far as I know, these are the ones that are actually doing business in Oregon, that we believe are doing business in Oregon.
Okay.
So they would have nexus here.
Great. Thank you. Anything else? Thank you. Representative Benson.
So I'm just curious, is there going to be a substantial difference between the way we did it for the initial few months and the way we're doing it now when it comes to revenue collected? Or do we too early to know?
Mr. Chair and Representative Benz, I think I would defer to Legislative Revenue Office to look at the statistics in our tax return data. I don't know what those numbers are, and I don't know if there's a significant increase or decrease or change at all. But I think we could look to find that answer through tax return information.
We didn't expect there to be a big increase, mm-hmm. did we?
Mr. Chair, no, I don't believe. I think Mazin did the estimate originally, and I don't think it was, I think Kyle may have said a couple million dollars over a biennium, or maybe it was a year, but I don't think it was really a huge increase.
And the number that we have right now suggests that it might be a little more than that, I think.
Perhaps, yeah.
Yeah.
A little bit more.
We'll flesh that out.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much. Very much appreciate the report and the information. It is now 4:45. Earned Income Tax Credit Participation Modifications, Department of Revenue.
That's me again.
You're there.
I'm here.
Don't move.
So,
Chris, you want to introduce the topic?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this one's a bit unusual in that it's an update on a bill that did not pass. Toward the end of the session, there was a lot of concern about the utilization and the participation and claiming of the Earned Income Tax Credit, which, as the committee is aware, it's a federal tax credit. And if a taxpayer has, it can be as much as $3,000 to $6,000, depending on the income and number of children. And Oregon's tax credit is 8% of that. So there was a report released that indicated a number of Oregonians who were eligible to claim the credit were not, in fact, claiming the credit. And in that sense, the Oregon economy was missing out on federal dollars that could be brought into Oregon. There was a bill, House Bill 4144, attempted to create an EITC task force utilization. The task force, the bill did not pass, so that didn't happen. But throughout those conversations and the desire among members of the legislature to move forward with increasing that utilization, the Department of Revenue was able to make to take some actions on its own that did not require legislation. Mm-hmm. And Deanna is here to update the committee on those actions.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, again, Deanna Mack, Department of Revenue. And I'm here today to talk about, just like Chris mentioned, the information that we give related to earned income tax credit and generally low-income tax credits, folks that are low-income. As he mentioned, House Bill 4144 got all the way to be engrossed version, did not pass. What we did do is it did ask for us to provide information not just about the earned income tax credit, but also about free file information for taxpayers, so it's more findable. We had just undergone a revision of our website at that point in time, and it was very difficult to find, so the bill was going to require us to bring it up to the homepage. It also wanted us to show vendors that were approved by the IRS for free file, as well as work on outreach strategies for things like the Earned Income Tax Credit Awareness Day, that kind of stuff. Prior versions of the bill actually talked about just any low-income tax credit, not just the earned income tax credit. So that's why I brought you a little brochure I'll talk about in a little bit. So while the bill did not pass, we still heard what you said. And we put into place things, because we don't need to have legislation to do the things that you're wanting us to do. We're happy to take feedback and implement it as time goes by. So what we did was we did listen. We put that free file information. It is on our homepage now. It's a link at the top. I think it goes to Revenue Online, and then it goes to Free File, and it takes you to a page that links you to AARP, links you to cash, and it links you to Free File vendors, so that people who are in the lower income or mid to low income folks can get Free File services from the various approved IRS and DOR approved vendors. It's also listed on the individual page, not just our homepage, but in the popular topics section of our individual homepage. It doesn't really necessarily make a lot of sense to put it on our property tax page, so we use some analytics, and it's on the page for individuals. We also added the EITC information. There's an EITC assistant on the federal website that tells people how, because it's not, like Chris said, it's not an Oregon tax credit. It's very much a federal thing, and so they have to go through all these qualifiers in order to figure out if they qualify. And IRS does have this really nice assistant on their website, so we link to that so that folks can enter their information and figure out if they qualify. Then there's a simple calculation for Oregon, a percentage of whatever they qualify for federal. We've also decided to use social media to promote the IRS information about the EITC eligibility. So they tweet about it, and we're retweeting their tweets about their Tax Awareness Day on January 29th every year. It's around the end of January. So we're using social media to do that, and that's going to happen every year going forward. We're also working with our partners at DHS to add the eligibility information on their one eligibility site that they're putting out. That's going to roll out, I believe, in 2017 or 2018. We're working to make sure that that information is put on their website as well. And also in 2015, you passed the new, Chris worked very hard with Representative Kenny Geyer on the new Working Family Household Dependent Care Credit. And that is also for low income. It replaced the old Working Family Credit and the Child Independent Care Credit and merged it into one credit. So we created a brochure for folks to understand. That's what I handed out to you. It will be available on our website the week of October 3rd, I'm told, and then it's coming back from the printer next week. So these are proofs. They will look a little bit nicer when they actually have been professionally printed and not printed on my printer. We did create those. They're going to be distributed into our district offices. They're going to be distributed over at DHS, at Employment Department, because a lot of providers are through the child care office there, and then cash and as an organization, a private organization. And then we're going to continue to discuss these new law updates every time we have a tax practitioner update, new law update every year as we go around. So this is the follow-up of the things that we did in response to what you said about House Bill 4144, in spite of it not passing. So if you have any questions about our efforts at trying to educate folks on what options they have to file, what credits they have available to them, let me know. Happy to help.
Great. Questions, comments? Let me just say I appreciate very much the effort to pursue getting low-income, often low-information families aware of these kinds of opportunities for themselves. A couple of suggestions occur to me that you probably are already doing, but that you didn't mention. Making sure that the food banks have information available to hand out to people who come for a food box during that time of the year, people who manage free and reduced lunch at school, so that because they often have contact with families and can provide things like this flyer, you know, to go home in the kid's backpack or in his lunchbox. Mm-hmm. And a variety, I mean, there's a whole lot of things you can do that probably are not real high cost that would actually give you a direct contact with families and that, you know, don't necessarily occur unless you're thinking in a much broader way. The newspaper is probably not a very efficient way to do it, partly because they're not likely to print it. And even if they do, the people who need to know it may not read the newspaper. because again, that's an expense that families can't afford. But I think I certainly do, and I think suspect the committee appreciates the work to get this out. Now, the question I have is on the updates for your website. Are you working with DAS and NICUSA on the front pages of your website to make sure that they're as user-friendly as you can manage?
Mr. Chair, we are, absolutely. We have to work with DAS, and they have the main portal for the state of Oregon and the right. main visual presence of it. So that's one of the reasons why we were working to say we need time to work with our partners at DAS and NICUSA to make sure that the content is in the right places.
Yeah, part of the reason I ask the question is I'm on the Portals Commission, and I know because of that connection that they have done tremendous work for a number of departments whose front pages were not particularly useful, but because of the use of focus groups and reviews of how people actually use the page, and ended up with pages that turned out to be quite useful and that turned out to be positive for interaction with the government by people in Oregon. And, of course, the tax man, of all people, needs as much positive publicity as possible. So, for what that's worth, Representative Whitsitt, please.
I was wondering if there's an age limitation on a disabled spouse. So, like when they reach retirement age or something, then if they're eligible for Medicare, they no longer are under the qualifying individuals, or if it includes people over the age of that could receive Medicare.
Mr. Chair and Representative Whitsitt, the requirement on determining whether a person is disabled is a federal requirement. It's, I believe, under, Chris, correct me if I'm wrong, the Child and Dependent Care Credit, it's the same definition they use there. I don't think that there is an age limit for if you have a disabled spouse and you have to give that kind of care that they can't take care of themselves, then you can pay to have someone do that for you and qualify those expenses for this credit.
So, follow up. It could be elderly then that are. I don't know the federal law, so disabled. But would it? I'm trying to figure out if you're no longer of working age, are you considered disabled under the federal law?
Mr. Chair and Representative Whitsitt, I can confirm, but I don't believe that there is an age limit.
Okay, great. Thank you,
Representative Vance.
Sure. Just very briefly, I'm this is really more of a, I don't think I want you to change this, but I was just looking at it and I thought its purpose is to educate people to the fact that this benefit is available. That's the idea, wasn't it? I think if I recall correctly, we were saying, hey, we have this program, people don't know about it, it's not functioning the way that it should. And when I looked at this, I don't see anything that explains our motives and why we're offering such a program, and I'm not sure that it's your job to explain it, but it's one thing to describe the benefit. It's an additional thing to say, and oh, by the way, here's why this crazy state is doing this. There's a reason we're doing this, and more to the point, that it's a we that's doing this, and I don't know. I don't want a 40-page volume attached to this thing, but it is interesting to me that we make these benefits available, but we never really talk about why or explain to those who are enjoying them, if that's the word. Needing them is the better word. We don't really carry it out further. And you guys that are on these committees that manage these kind of devices would be better suited to say how that element of this program is managed. But I'm not saying it should be here. I was just struck by its absence and wondered where we would see it. Because the underlying concept was, hey, the EITC is to help you. We're so happy you're working. We're going to help. And then the idea is you'll move through this space, and someday your life will be the better for it. We'll all be the better for it. It doesn't say that here, and I'm not sure it should. But I throw this out in front of the committee basically to say, hey, you know.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Bence, we do have just a really quick sentence about the purpose of the credit, and that it's to help offset the cost of child care for low to mid-income folks on the first paragraph at the end of the first paragraph, but it might not be enough. It just says the purpose is this.
Mr. Chair. Yeah, please.
So,
yeah.
You know, Craig, just out another sentence, it would be the rest of the taxpayers in Oregon are trying to help you. That's right. This money didn't just fall out of the sky someplace. We're trying to help.
We'll take that feedback and send it back to the program staff. That's great. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, Roxanne Nose.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I just missed it when you were explaining it. I'm on your website, and I see the tax, the free tax filing stuff very prominent. Where did you say the EITC stuff is?
It's on the page, Mr. Chair and Representative Nose. It's on the page, on the individual page for free file. There should be a link over there for it.
Do I need to find the dates? Right, all right, I'll look. I'll check it. Earned income tax instructions. Okay.
You know, it occurs to
it's
me.
It's still, I would not know to look there, though. That's the only thing. It's harder to, it's not intuitive for me.
Well, of course, that's one of the reasons why I suggested that they work really closely with DAS and with NICUSA to figure out how to build a page like this. Some of the other agencies of the state had written pages that they thought worked just fine and turned out that they were exactly backwards. Mm-hmm. And so this is not a problem just of the department. It's a lot of other departments have had similar kinds of things where the new page ended up looking really similar to the old one, but the links were completely different. Mm-hmm. For example, right. Some of the ones that we have seen that we've seen working.
And Mr. Chair, we recognize too the analytics. We use analytics to try and determine yes. what goes in what places. But sometimes, if it's hard to find, the analytics can be deceiving because it might have a low click ratio, but it could be because no one can find it. So we're aware of that as well.
Yeah. Right, and that's part of why you use focus groups.
Right.
You get some low income people in front of your web page and ask them to do it, mm-hmm. and then you watch them carefully and see what happens.
Right.
And if they can't find it, then, of course, you've obviously got to think of something else.
Well, and one more point, though, too, is most tax returns, Mr. Chair, are filed using software. We have, I think, 86%. So it's automatically calculated for most people who are eligible. It's the little – and 2D barcode makes up most of the difference. So that's, again, software prepared. So we have about 93-94% that's prepared using software or by a practitioner. So we're talking about a very small population of people who still use pen and ink on mm-hmm. forms. So it's really most people are using software, and software does calculate a form if they're eligible.
Ah, now that was something I was unaware of. Yeah.
Okay.
Great.
But you got to know to file taxes. You got to think to even file taxes, though.
Yes. Anything else? Thank you so much. Paul, you have Paul has something else, and then it will be 5 o'clock.
Paul better not have much.
Take about 30 seconds, Mr. Chair. I just want to remind the committee that we do have another meeting before December legislative days. It's one of our bonus meetings, which will be November 16th for the revenue forecast, and that of course will be the forecast that will be used for the governor's recommended budget. So November 16th, and we'll get out notice to everybody.
And will we get a report on the issue involving the Schedule E people at that time, or is that too fast?
I'm thinking maybe December.
Maybe December. December.
Yeah. December. I think it's more realistic.
Right, because
they get
those filings in right after October 15th. Right. So this is less than a month.
That would give us a little time to digest it for the December legislative day. So right. I think that's more realistic.
Thank
but November 16th, your next meeting.
Anything else? Thank you so much. I appreciate the attendance today, and the committee is adjourned. And my computer.